Welcome, folks. My name is Anthony Bubalo. I'm the research director here at the Lowy Institute for International Policy. And welcome to this Lowy lecture on Russia's Asian rebalance. I'd particularly like to acknowledge some esteemed guests in the audience, the Honourable Philip Ruddock, the former Minister for Immigration and Multicultural Affairs, and one of our, I think, second longest serving parliamentarians. So welcome to today's event. It's great to have you all here. It's a fascinating topic that we're going to talk to today. Unfortunately, there were going to be three of us here to talk about the topic. Ian Bond, a UK-Russian expert, unfortunately had to head home at very late notice as a result of a family issue. Nevertheless, the show must go on, and we have a more than capable person to help us talk through the great many issues raised by Russia's 21st century resurgence. Dr. Matthew Sussex is with us. He's a non-resident fellow here at the Lowy Institute, and he is now the Director of Academic Outreach and Research at the National Security College at the Australian National University. Previously, he was the Head of Politics and International Relations at the University of Tasmania. His research specializations include international security, Russian politics and foreign policy, strategic studies, and international relations theory. He is also the author of this paper, which we published in December last year, entitled Russia's Asian Rebalance. And there are copies of the paper around the place. So if you haven't already, please grab one. As I said, it's very, very topical. We've seen in the last few years the re-emergence, if you like, in the 21st century of a 20th century problem. A quarter of a century after the end of the Cold War, we're again talking about the Russian challenge, or even to some degree the Russian threat. NATO is again discussing threats on its borders, but we're also seeing that challenge elsewhere. Not just in Syria and the Middle East, but also in our own region, in Asia, as Russia, in the same way that the US has been talking in recent years about a rebalance to Asia, Russia certainly at least has those ambitions. And that's something we'll get to very much in the second part of our discussion. But I wanted to start off by asking Matthew about, I mean, really, when we talk about the Russian challenge, you cannot remove it from the personality of Vladimir Putin. And in many respects, you know, perhaps what we're talking about today is not the Russian challenge, but the Putin challenge, the way in which Putin is driving Russian policy in a way that fundamentally challenges some of its neighbours, Western policy. What is it that Putin wants?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think Putin wants what most leaders want, to be honest, which is security for his country in the long term. Whether or not he can actually get that is an entirely open question. But it's interesting that a couple of days ago I was listening to Ian Bond, who was going to be here today, address this very question. He said something very, very clever, I think, so I shall plagiarise it. He said, we can understand this in terms of the question, is Putin being strategic or is he being opportunistic? And the answer is yes to both. And I heartily agree with this, that Putin's foreign policy is one that on the one hand looks almost as though it seizes on every single opportunity to, first of all, make positive headlines for Russia. There is a public relations dimension. Second, to extract economic advantage for the Russian Federation. There's certainly a strong theme in that as well. And thirdly, some military security advantage as well. So on that sense, in the sort of broadest sense, it looks opportunistic. But I would suggest that there is an element of strategy to Russian foreign and security policy. And that is something that's driven by, for Putin at least, some quite unpalatable realities that Russia will face in the near future if it doesn't get on board with the Asian century, if it doesn't ensure that it has a good relationship with China, then it's very much going to find itself squeezed out The Russians like to say, Putin in fact has said, that Russia is special. Russia occupies an exceptional place in the world. It is neither Western nor is it Asian. It's something else. It's Eurasian. If Russia doesn't change and Russia doesn't adapt from where it's been in the past, then it's going to find itself a great big empty space between Europe on the one hand and Asia on the other. So there is opportunism in Russian foreign and security policy under Putin. He's very, very quick to seize on those opportunities. But by the same token, there is an underlying strategic rationale, I think, behind what he does.
But you could also, I mean, you know, look from the outside. Mm-hmm. You wonder, on one hand, you know, he's making a whole range of countries more fearful of Russia, certainly in Europe. And in every action he undertakes, there's an inevitable reaction. Is there any sense with Putin that he understands that, when you threaten to cut off gas supplies to Europe, one of the consequences is that Europeans will go and look elsewhere for their gas. When you make military incursions in Crimea, it's not going to stop NATO from focusing and building its military capabilities and focusing eastward. It's going to encourage that. Is there any sense you get from Putin and from people around him that they realise that this can also be highly counterproductive as well?
Oh, absolutely. Putin and his inner circle is often quite very hard to read. There are at least three or four different rival clans that compete for Putin's ear. So when we speak about Putin, we tend to do this in the assumption that Putin is the sole decision maker or the ultimate arbiter of what goes on in Russia. It's actually not always the case. But there is a cadre within the Kremlin that views international politics simply through the prism of power and influence, whereas we in the West would tend to talk about a rules-based order and prioritise those types of arrangements, institutions, agencies. For Russia, these are all very well, but they're someone else's rules. Mm. So it is for Putin the challenge to go against those rules and to tilt at windmills. And in fact, he actually has said in public a number of times that Russian foreign policy is better off doing this, being exceptionalist, than being part of, say, a common European home, which was the original vision of both Mikhail Gorbachev, in fact, and Boris Yeltsin as the first leader of the Russian Federation. So I think, by and large, Putin does realise that he is making enemies rather than friends, and he is not creating an atmosphere of trust. But I don't think he cares. And the real reason he doesn't care, whether it's Crimea or whether it's Syria, is because he is betting that the West's time has come, that it is the end of the liberal rules-based order.
Right. And how is this viewed within Russia itself? And talking about the broader population, we can talk about, you know, we can ask, what does Putin want? But what do Russians want? And, you know, do they agree with Putin? Do they go along with Putin in his foreign adventures? Or are you starting to see people question that as well?
Yeah. Russians, by and large, want, there's a Russian term, derzhavnost, right? Which means thinking and acting like a great power. Mm. They want to ensure that Russia has a position of international prominence, which really wasn't the case after the collapse of the USSR. Russia was an economic basket case. It demodernized. It had a president who, although he was a champion of democracy, was old, drunk, sick for most of the time. Putin comes along as plucked from obscurity, younger guy, black belt in judo, looks the part, promises almost nothing, except that I will restore Russia to a position of greatness. And the Russians buy into this in a big way. Russia goes into Chechnya a second time, and this time it wins, if in fact you can win at those types of conflict. Russia starts doing all sorts of things. In fact, previous to that, in Kosovo, Russia becomes a petro giant. So the Russians view Putin as someone who has restored Russian pride and Russian strength, and a sense of Russia as a great power. I'd argue it's not a great power, because you need a variety of things to be a great power, not just lots of oil and nuclear weapons. But nonetheless, the Russians would see that Russia has become a great power again. Do they support Putin? Yes, I think by and large they do. The Russian liberal intelligentsia, as we would know it in the West, is minuscule, tiny, tiny, tiny. Even those parties who we would associate with social democracy, which do exist, tend to echo Putin when it comes to foreign policy and security policy, even though they may push a different domestic angle. And so too, of course, does the far right. The far right will say, will bluster a lot in public. When it comes to committee meetings and any decisions to be made, they will always echo Putin's line. Two reasons for that. One is they lock in behind the president, they curry favour with him. Second reason, there's domestic political advantage in doing so, because even being attached to Putin or seen as being endorsing Putin gets electoral favour.
Does that domestic support, though, act as a bit of a double-edged sword, raise the stakes for foreign intervention? Because that's great if you're succeeding, and you know, certainly in Syria it seems to be working, and we'll come to Syria in a moment. But what if you fail? What if your foreign adventurism starts to expose the frailties of this status as a great power? Is there a real danger there for Putin?
There is. There is a huge danger, and this is why Crimea is instructive, because going into Crimea was the jewel in the crown for Russia in terms of Russian pride. We talk about Russian sense of new destiny, new purpose. Crimea was the absolute jewel in the crown, getting that back. Having built a domestic desire for triumph with every single foreign policy move, it is really difficult to see where Putin's going to go next. Mm. He's gone to Syria, and it seems to be working out okay for him at the moment. But where would he go locally? Would he go into Kazakhstan, say, when Nursultan Nazarbayev dies? He's getting very old. Would that replicate the sense of triumph in Crimea? What happens when Russia's petrol and gas dollars start drying up, as they are drying up now, because of the very, very low oil price? It's not just something that's affecting producers in the West. It's affecting Russia very much as well. So there is that danger that Putin has overreached, if you like, and how he will extricate himself from that is going to be very interesting.
One of the interesting elements of this as well is, you know, there's a tendency to see Putin as, particularly in the West, as, you know, this kind of cartoonish figure, the kind of the shirtless judo displays, all those kinds of things. Yet, you know, beyond those countries that are immediately allied with Russia, you also see this almost admiration for Putin. In France, for example, you know, at a popular level, there seems to be this admiration for Putin. In the Middle East, you know, even people that don't like Russian policy will say, well, you know, at least Russia sticks by its allies, unlike, you know, unlike the West. I mean, do you think he's also tapping into that desire for a bit of, you know, for the great, decisive, strong kind of leader where you know where you stand?
Definitely. I mean, even the American right, aspects of the American right will say that Putin is a strong man, wish we had that in the United States. Mm. So you even find support for Putin in the West as well. And this is why, one of the reasons why he makes, you know, such great clickbait whenever the media writes a story, you know, with Putin in it. Everybody wants to see what he's up to, regardless of whether he's wrestling a bear or whether he's doing something in Syria. I think amongst particularly non-democracies or semi-authoritarian states, Putin carries particular cachet because they can model themselves on him. And if they can be close to him, the individual, as well, this is particularly the case in Central Asia, if they can be close to him, then they can again get some of that reflected sense of power and achievement, if you like. The Russians also, under Putin, do send a message to leaders of countries that are authoritarian, and that message is, if you are our ally, we will stand by you. That is the individual, not necessarily just your state. The Russian narrative on the West in the Middle East, say, is that the West abandoned Hosni Mubarak, threw him under a bus, right? Whereas someone like Assad will be looked after, will get a golden parachute at the very least.
Mm. Well, let's go to Syria now. Yep. Before we talk about some of the details, I mean, one of the question marks, certainly amongst Middle East watchers, is why? You know, why has Russia suddenly again taken this interest in the Middle East and in Syria in particular?
Yeah. Well, Syria is an interesting one for Russia because it has military assets there, or at least access to the naval base at Tartus. So there is a strategic reason. Even though it's largely symbolic, it gives Russia a presence in the region. And if you have a military presence, even if it's a small one, then it means that you have some kind of say or stake in regional security dynamics. So there's that aspect to it. The other aspect is that there is a large amount of Russian investment in Syria. And if that is to go south, if Assad goes, then you would anticipate that one of the other groups, whether it's ISIS or whether it's a sort of free alliance in Syria takes over, then that trade will suffer. And the third aspect is what I was talking about previously, which is I think that the Russians have invested in Assad, the individual, as well, and banked a lot on keeping him in power. It may be that they'd be prepared, the Russians, this is, to accept a compromise, but that would have to be down the track, and things would have to turn against the current government in Damascus, because thanks to Russian airstrikes, the opposition to Assad is being quite heavily attrited, leaving on the one hand ISIS and on the other hand Assad.
So can I draw you out a bit more on that? I mean, how do you think this significant Russian military intervention is going? I mean, we've certainly seen it break what was, until last year, very much a stalemate between the regime and the opposition. What do you see in over the next kind of 12 months? How do you see that campaign going?
Well, it depends how, if we get any progress at all or a restart on peace talks, and it depends whether they go anywhere. My suspicion is they won't, simply because there are so many actors involved and so many potential opportunities for it to just dissolve. And in peace talks like this, it will move at the pace of the very, very slowest member, and also anyone can derail it. So the process of that negotiation itself is problematic for a successful outcome. In terms of the actual military campaign, the Russians are targeting, what, about 70% opposition that aren't ISIS. So they are really heavily bombing those who were, the West would identify, not all of them, but many the West would identify as being an opponent of Assad and yet not radicalized, not member of, not on the ISIS side. Assuming that that continues unfettered, and I'm not quite sure what the West could do to prevent it, except come to the Russians and say, okay, can we have a retargeting effort against ISIS? Will the Russians agree to that? I think Russia's line in the sand will be, well, Assad stays.
The interesting challenge for the Russians is the one I suppose we faced in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's one thing to get a military victory. I mean, that's the easy part. It's what you do with it afterwards. The West, the US, NATO invested billions of dollars in after the military campaign was won to support the governments in Afghanistan and new governments in Iraq to very very variable effects, to put it mildly. Would the Russians be prepared to make that, say they've turned the tables now, they were able to beat back the opposition enough for it to be able to say, well, the Assad has won. That's not the end of the game. They would have to make, billions of dollars of investment to prop up the Assad regime. Would the Russians be prepared to do that over an extended period of time? And do they have the money to do it?
Absolutely not, and for the very, very reason you mentioned. They don't have the money, and also, to be honest, I don't think they have the inclination. If they help Assad win, then Assad will be beholden to Moscow for the rest of his tenure. And that will be enough for the Kremlin, because they will have direct access to military facilities should they want them, pre-positioning, pre-stationing military hardware, economic ties, trade ties, favourable deals on trade and energy and so forth.
Let's turn to our own region now. In the paper that you wrote for us in December, you talked about Russia's Asia rebalance. What did you mean by that?
Well, Russia has said a number of times before, we're going to look at Asia, we're going to get really into Asia. We are not just a European power, even though the majority of Russians would live on that European side. It's never really followed through on it. This time, however, at least I think, Putin is serious, and he's serious for the same reasons as the United States is serious about rebalancing to Asia. Now, the US, of course, famously said that the US would, of necessity, rebalance to the Asia-Pacific because of, I think, what it referred to as the unprecedented transfer of wealth and power. And certainly Australian prime ministers have used this language as well. Putin believes it too. But Putin believes that he can pivot to the east in a way that he will extract not only or preserve Russia's economic integrity, but also significant strategic weight and membership in a new anti-current rules-based order, if you like. So a kind of ideological or normative union, compact with the People's Republic of China. And if Asia is going to be the engine room of globalization, then Putin is saying that that's where he needs to be.
I'm interested to talk a little bit about that Russia-China relationship. There's a lot of speculation about how deep it goes, how likely the Chinese are going to want to simply fold in kind of neatly behind Putin's plan. I mean, it used to be the case, and maybe still is to a degree, that, you know, for example, in the Security Council, when the Russians voted one way, the Chinese voted with them, didn't like to be exposed, tucked in behind, but were not kind of high profile. And we saw that certainly on Syria. But, you know, Russia operating in East Asia is a different story altogether. How willing do you think the Chinese are going to be to kind of cooperate with Russian plans? You know, what future do you really see for this, you know, prospective Russia-Chinese tie-up?
Russia is definitely the junior partner in this relationship, and it's something that the decision makers, academics in Russia have had a long time trying to come to grips with. Now, on the surface, Xi Jinping will come to Moscow and talk about a new model of great power cooperation and how Russia is an equal partner. In reality, the Chinese know that they are in the box seat in that relationship, because what the Russians need desperately is investment. There is absolutely no way the Russians can open up the Far East, which is the real Wild West. And there's really only one route that goes through it at the moment. It's going to need monumental investment in order to tap into the resources that are there so that the Russians can be in a position to say to Europe, we don't need to sell you gas anymore, we'll sell it to the Chinese or the Japanese or the South Koreans. And that money is going to come from China. So there was a phrase I read recently that I quite liked, and that was that the Chinese are boiling the Russian frog. And of course, when you boil a frog, you have the heat low, and you turn it up and up, and the frog basks in the water, and all of a sudden he's cooked. Now, the Russians know this too, but there's very little that they can do about it, because they just don't have the resources to. So we say that the relationship is a sort of mile wide and an inch deep, and that's true to an extent, although they have put away a lot of their differences, particularly over borders. 1996, they resolved the issue of borders over which they fought wars, real wars, during the Cold War era. So there is significant change at that level. There's also significant change symbolically, where you have Chinese troops marching in Red Square last year. This would have been absolutely unthinkable. Just a few years previously, you have joint exercises between the Chinese and the Russians. But again, the Russians are the junior partner in this. They're spending a lot of money on their Pacific fleet, which they need to because it was rotting, quite literally rotting at anchor. But within 5 years or so, 5 to 10 years, they will start to have a reasonable capacity, at least in Northeast Asia. Does that mean that Russia and China will always be strategic allies? Not necessarily. Because the Russians sometimes do things like sell military hardware to the Vietnamese, who the Chinese regard as an adversary. So the Russians need to counterbalance what is commercial in their approach and what is strategic, going back to this question of, you know, is it strategic, is it opportunistic?
Leaving China aside, I mean, what does it mean? I mean, you know, there's still a question mark about whether the rebalance will happen, particularly with oil prices likely to be low for a prolonged period. But assuming that over time it does happen, what does it mean for the region? What does it mean for a country like Australia? I mean, how do the Russians see us?
Well, let me talk about how Russians see us. Some Russians don't see Australia as a country at all, and have said so publicly. They say, well, you have a foreign head of state, you have a large territory, a bit like Russia, but you have no way of safeguarding it. You have to rely on great and powerful friends, so you don't really have any sovereignty. You don't have a vote, or at least a veto, in the UN Security Council, so you're not a country. There's a famous story, actually. Do I have time? A couple of minutes to recount? All right. It concerns a former Australian Prime Minister who will remain nameless.
Well, there's enough of them, so...
Yeah. Recently former, and there's enough of those. Yeah. This individual is quite active at the moment. But anyway, hosted Sergei Lavrov, the Russian Foreign Minister, at the Sydney Opera House for a state dinner. And Sergei Lavrov comes in with his minders, and the Australian Prime Minister with his lot, and they meet. And a waiter comes up with a drink. And the Australian Prime Minister says, beer, Australia's favourite drink, fantastic, you know, have a beer with me. Lavrov says, on an occasion like this, surely we would have a whiskey. The Australian Prime Minister says, of course, go away and bring us some whiskey. Waiter comes back with whiskey. Australian Prime Minister says, whiskey, fantastic, on the rocks, just the way I like it. Lavrov says, surely you would not put ice in whiskey. Go away, come back. Whiskey comes back neat. Former Australian Prime Minister, almost gave it away, says, neat whiskey, absolutely fantastic, drink with me. And Lavrov says, I like soda water in my whiskey. So the Russians will toy with leaders, and they will publicly embarrass leaders when they feel that they can get away with it. How does Russia view Australia? A bit of a non-entity, but potentially a competitor when it comes to things like energy, when it comes to iron ore, when it comes to coal. Prices of all those things are rock bottom at the moment. The worry is that the Russians are prepared to sell these commodities at a loss. And there are strong indications that they are selling gas at a loss to the Chinese, the big $400 billion gas deal, and there may be more to come. That's a worry for Australia because it does mean the entry of a new energy competitor. Mm-hmm. And Australia's energy security is reliant on energy trade, not so much on production, on energy trade. The recent white paper says that it's vital to Australia's energy security that we ramp up production and trade within the region. Now, the Chinese and other countries know this as well, and China, of course, is casting around to buy from whomever it can get the best deal. The worry is that if the Russians provide that best deal, then the Chinese may have no compunction in saying, sure, we'll sign up with Gazprom, we'll sign up with Rosneft, as opposed to Australia. So there are stakes for Australia as well.
It's time to take some questions from the audience. Please raise your hand, wait for the microphone, and tell us who you are. Philip Ruddock, down the front here, just wait for the microphone.
One phrase you used, and you didn't expand it, and that was, the West's time has come.
Yeah.
Would you care to expand on it?
Certainly. Doesn't mean that I endorse this comment, but there is a Russian view that the end of the Cold War marked the triumph of democratic individualism. And this is the sort of Fukuyama thesis, the end of history, that the big tension between ideology the big fight had been held, and there was a winner, and democracy was the winner. And associated with that, capitalism was the winner. Yeah. The Russian view is that that was a false hope, a false vision, and a false promise. That what it created was bloc politics, that it really just shifted the boundaries of bipolarity of the Cold War eastwards. That's all it did. A few countries in Eastern Europe became democracies. Russia had the opportunity to. The West came in with various advisors, particularly the United States, various advisors from the Harvard Institute of International Development, came up with a terrible transition scheme from a plan to the plan to the market. Russia demodernized, ruble collapsed, economy went backwards. The Russian view is that's not the right economic model for Russia. It's not also the right political model. The Russians, or at least the Kremlin, would argue that democracy produces bureaucracy. It produces chaos. It becomes sclerotic, if you like. It collapses under the weight of its own inertia. So they would see the global financial crisis as partly a product of that. And this is not Marxist-Leninist economics, it's just in, how they would express the crisis in democratic states, whether there is one or not. Right? They would say, well, we have higher voting rates than the United States, higher voter participation. Who's more democratic? So the Russian narrative is very much that, whereas the type of rules-based order we're used to living under, institutional, international law, respect for treaties and so forth, may be good for those who signed up to it and who benefit from it the most, there are countries like Russia and countries like China and, for that matter, even countries in Southeast Asia who don't benefit. And that an alternative, whether it's a sort of neo-mercantilist system or some kind of sovereign democracy, which is what the Russians used to portray as their new ideological vision, is a better answer.
Standing in front.
Hi, Rob McDougall. I'm the Canadian Consul General for the time being. You talked extensively about the Putin's support among the Russian population on foreign policy issues. I guess I'd be interested in your views on where the balance lies between Russia, what Putin sees as Russian foreign policy interests in terms of promoting his vision of what Russia is and should be, and doing things abroad in places like the Crimea and Syria because it helps him with his popular support. I mean, because the balance between those two will determine what he's likely to do and how we should respond to it.
Yep, that's a very good question. I don't want to give a flippant answer, but the flippant surface answer is that they are one and the same. Putin's domestic vision of his foreign domestic support in terms of his foreign policy agenda and what he sees as Russian interests, that's one potential answer. I think a more nuanced answer is countries can say a variety of things about what their aims are, what their interests are, and certainly Russia in its new sort of national security concept has been fairly blunt in what it thinks its interests are, and that is a sphere of influence in the former Soviet space, basically post-imperial space. The big question is, do you actually have the wherewithal? Do you have the capability to do what you say you're going to do? Crimea, yes. And this is an interesting case study in what has Canberra jumping up and down at the moment, hybrid war, and what does this mean for the future of conflict and the future of warfare? Crimea, yes. Eastern Ukraine, yes. But then again, Ukraine is a special case, because Ukraine was a problem that no one wanted to own and everybody wanted to meddle in. And I do think it was the fault, partially, of both Putin meddling, but also the European Union getting it wrong through the Eastern Partnerships, which basically makes Ukraine choose between the Eurasian Union on the one hand and closer association, but never membership in the EU on the other. And given the big split, virtually 50-50 down the line between ethnic Russians and those who would associate themselves more with the West, not just ethnic Russians, right? That was going to be a very, very hard choice. So on that level, can Putin go further? Can he create, can he take over the whole of Ukraine? Well, no, he doesn't want to. I think really what he wants there is a sort of balkanized Ukraine. That shores up the sphere of influence. He's going to have real worries, I think, in Central Asia, because at the moment he is paying the security bill in Central Asia, and that suits him just fine, because the Central Asian states will come to Moscow when it comes to problems in their own countries, whether it's counterterrorism issues that they need dealing with, whether it's any other type of domestic unrest. Russia looks after that. China is muscling in on Central Asia in a very big way, signing all sorts of bilateral deals, mainly related to energy, but also related to infrastructure development. If that starts changing attitudes in places like Kazakhstan, in Kyrgyzstan, and so forth, then you may see a shift, a gravitation by those Central Asian states towards China. Russia is very keen, very fond of calling the post-Soviet area the near abroad, right? Central Asia is China's near abroad, and at the moment they're content with the Russians picking up the bulk of the bill for that. But what happens when those attitudes start to change, when that area does start to gravitate towards China? That is a worrying point for Putin. And he will need much more capabilities than he has at the moment, I think, to control it.
Good afternoon, Pete Levy from in the Navy. I wonder if you could expand on Russia's activities up in the Arctic.
Yes.
It seems to me that a lot of it's been grandstanding, but have they got a head start on other nations in getting set up there as the global warming takes hold?
Well, to an extent, it might be waiting a while for all of it to melt to be economically viable. Yes, they have got a head start to an extent. Ultimately, it's too expensive still. It's interesting to note that where there are other European players, and Canada to an extent, and even the United States to an extent as well, interested in this type of space, that when the sanctions on Russia over Ukraine came out, one of the things there was access to technology for drilling. So the idea is to put the brakes on the Russians before they can start developing it. The Russians are very fond of going in submarines and planting a Russian tricolour on the seabed. That doesn't necessarily mean that they are able to claim, hold and secure that territory. Will it happen in the future? Possibly. But just as likely is that you will see Russian military adventurism, I think, even coming down towards our region. The G20 thing was symbolic. It was a show of force. It was, look what we've got. Reports were that there were a couple of submarines involved as well, because to highlight Australia's lack of anti-submarine warfare capacity, we can operate with impunity in the Coral Sea off Brisbane, right? So in terms of the Arctic, there is an economic rationale for Russia to do that, but at the moment that money is probably better spent, and it's Chinese money that's being spent, developing the Far East and transport corridors that will open up gas lanes into China on the one hand, and depending on the relationship with Turkey, through Turkey into the EU, or bypassing the EU, and possibly even rerouting southeast towards India. Yeah.
Just here. Yeah, and then we'll go.
Павел Ванечкин, I work for the Russian news agency TASS. There's a very strong argument which heavily exploited by the officials in my country, and let me testify, it has a very strong appeal to the, first and foremost, to the elder generation of Russians, and recently to the younger ones. So what has happened, let's say, 30 years ago? There was some kind of meeting between Mr. Gorbachev and James Baker, and at that meeting, there was some kind of agreement that after the unification of Germany, NATO wouldn't move to the east. So according to the proponents of this argument, Moscow was honest in its obligation and Washington was not. So NATO moved to the east, and when now there is some kind of argument that Putin have some threats to the security of NATO, Russians say, what kind of countries are you talking? Estonia, Poland, Czech, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, they were Russian satellites or republics. So NATO moved to the east and Putin just defended some kind of... You can talk about democracy, military blocs. So do you think that this argument have some validity or it's absolutely groundless?
No, I do think it has some validity, because security and security threats are about perceptions. And if countries choose to perceive the activities of someone else as threatening, then it becomes a security issue, doesn't it? There's a fantastic counterfactual which Russia's former prime minister and former foreign minister, Yevgeny Primakov, came up with when talking to, I think it was a Western media outlet. And he said, consider this counterfactual, right? The Cold War has ended and the Soviet Union has won. Germany unifies and joins the Warsaw Pact. Russia, or the Soviet Union, says to the United States, you have nothing to fear. This is primarily a defensive alliance. You can't join yet, right? But nonetheless, we need, you know, new countries in this alliance. France petitions for membership in the Warsaw Pact and joins it. The United Kingdom petitions for membership in the Warsaw Pact and joins it. Soviet Union says, there is no threat. We're not threatening you. And then Canada and Mexico petition for membership in the Warsaw Pact. And Primakov's point was, wouldn't you feel threatened, particularly under the deal that was offered to the Russians? And the deal that was offered to the Russians was partnerships for peace, yeah, but not full membership, so that every member currently in NATO gets a veto over decisions. So Russia had, it was a special case. It could be a member, but not have a veto. Voice, but no veto. And I think a lot of Russian frustrations with the West stem from this fact of history. I would say, though, that it is now a fact of history. And if we are going to see any chance of cooperation in the future, then there are going to have to be compromises on both sides. And both the Russian Federation will have to compromise, and NATO will have to compromise as well.
Hi, Ruth Wiseman from the British High Commission. You said that the only choice left for the West will be on Syria is to join with Russia against Daesh, and for that we would have to accept that Assad stays. I can see how Russia might be trying to create that choice for us, that you can either, you clear out the moderate opposition, the people in the middle, you clear them from the battlefield, you end up with a choice between Assad and Daesh. And the assumption would be that we would support and try and get rid of Daesh. But isn't there a flaw in this plan that even if certain countries did decide to do that, that there are countries in the region whose objective isn't necessarily getting rid of Daesh, but actually that Assad goes, and actually that you strengthen Daesh because all the people who are left from the moderate opposition join that organization, and you keep on strengthening it as people go to fight from overseas, etc. And that leaves a threat for us as well. Isn't that a bit of a flaw in his plan?
Potentially, yes. However, does it really... I'm going to speculate here and say, does Putin really care? Because he can always make it someone else's problem, ultimately. As long as Assad stays there, in Damascus, for the moment, he can make ISIS, Daesh, whatever you want to call it, the problem of the West, and effectively that's what he's, or the problem of NATO, and that's effectively what he's done at the moment. It does muddy the water, I think, with Saudi Arabia announcing just recently that it was going to get involved with boots on the ground, and that will potentially, first of all, they didn't seem to have told the Americans that they were going to be doing that, and I think the State Department said, "Well, we support all efforts to get to a resolution in this crisis, but we're fast finding out what's happening." And of course, it makes Iran another strategic and an even more important strategic player, because if you have a clash between the Iranians, at the moment it's a proxy war, right? But if you have a clash between the Iranians and the Saudis, then you have all sorts of troubles. The Russians will back the Iranians, of course, even though they've been playing a lot of fast diplomacy with the Saudis over the last year or so. It hasn't really worked out for them. The Russians will back the Iranians, and you have the setting for potentially quite a nasty geopolitical crisis in the region. Who does that hurt the most? I would suspect, at least in the battle of public affairs, public wills, I think it probably would hurt the West more, given that it has had to change its opinion or change its focus on what is a red line and what isn't a red line.
Back there.
Ian Enright, you mentioned towards the end of your presentation the sale by China of $400 billion worth of gas, sale by Russia to China at a loss. Is there a Russian motive behind taking a loss that there will be some other but reciprocal benefit? And what might that be?
Yeah, it's to lock in long-term contracts. So if you sign at a loss initially for 25-year contracts and infrastructure development, then you can sign subsequent deals at a different price. Or at least that is one aspect of the Russian approach, I think, to this. The other aspect, of course, is that it locks out your competition. So there are plenty of countries wanting to sell gas to China, and the Chinese have an embarrassment of suitors for their money. The Russians will make the argument pipelines are better because they exist or can be built and stay there and can handle large volumes, and they're landlocked, you don't have to worry about insurance so much, sea transit, etc. We'll build lots of pipelines, we'll sign you up to a 25-year deal, then let's talk about a 30-year deal. then let's extend it, but let's tinker with the price. As basically what it's done with Eastern Europe since the collapse of the, since its re-emergence. It was always supplying gas, but since its re-emergence as an energy giant, if you like. So its calculation is, well, maybe we can do that in Asia. There's a problem with that, and the problem is everybody's wise to it. However, the temptation of low price may be enough to get players on board and signing up. At the moment, of course, price is low. It's not so much of an issue, but it may be in the future.
Jenny Howard-Jones.
Hi, Matthew. In the last few weeks, we've seen a large Russian arms shipment arrive in Fiji, probably the most visible demonstration of Russian presence in the Pacific Islands since the Cold War. And this has come on the back of successive Fiji attempts to broaden its relationships with emerging powers, and in particular Russia. And we're apparently Russian army officials are going to come and train their Fijian counterparts in the next few weeks. I was just wondering what you thought Russia will get out of this and what it wants from Fiji and the region.
It's a very good question. I'm not an expert on the South Pacific at all, but my guess is that this is part of the opportunistic side as opposed to a strategic calculation that there's a real possibility of a Russian military base in Suva. What they would do with that base, I don't know. I don't think they'd be able to use it, to be honest. They've only got one aircraft carrier in their fleet at the moment. They have some heavy cruisers, but they're based in Vladivostok. So what are you going to do? You're going to ship them down there to refit or something and then chug around the Pacific, thumbing your nose at the Americans? Well, you know, possibly, but I'm not quite sure whether there's any long-term strategic value to the Russian Federation in doing this. What there is symbolic value, and there is some commercial value as well. We'll sell you arms, and the Russians are big arms players, just as many other countries are. We'll sell you arms, we'll make some money out of it, and we will ensure that you buy our tech, because you'll become dependent on it, you'll find those systems are most useful to you, you're comfortable with them, and you'll become a long-term customer. So beyond symbolism and that sheer just commercial edge, I don't think there's a huge amount to it. There's also some symbolism, for instance. There was an announcement recently that by the Kremlin, not by the Kremlin, I think it was Sputnik, so we don't necessarily call that the Kremlin, although they're close, that Russia was interested in opening negotiations with New Zealand in terms of the Eurasian Economic Union. Again, what Russia would really want out of New Zealand as a member or an associate of the Eurasian Economic Union, I'm not quite sure. But these are, again, part of the what's partly a popularity, or at least a popular contest, with commercial add-ons, if you like.
The lady in the front there.
Thank you, Francesca Betti. Could you comment a little more on the West, on subcontinent, when we talk about Asia?
In terms of the relationship with India? The Russian relationship with India is an interesting one. If on one level it looks very strong, or at least as though it's accelerating, Russia has wanted what it calls strategic triangles for quite a while. The argument made by even Boris Yeltsin when towards the latter stages of his presidency was that if you could unite Moscow, New Delhi and Beijing in some kind of loose framework, then you would have captured a large proportion of the world's territory, large proportion of its population, and therefore its power. That's not going to happen, of course. That's not going to come about because of natural difficulties between New Delhi and Beijing, and conflicting interests on both sides. Also conflicting interests, frankly, between Moscow and Beijing, too. But the Moscow-New Delhi axis is one that looks very promising. There have been announcements of nuclear reactors, if you like, as part of this, that the Russians are going to build, I think, 20 nuclear reactors in India, that they're cooperating on the next generation fighter, the Sukhoi, but that's been stuck for quite a while. That's been in progress for 5-6 years, and it's been delayed numerous times. And I think it was about 2 weeks ago the Russians announced again that there was going to be another delay in that cooperative process. So again, when we look at relations between Moscow and major power centres, and New Delhi is certainly one as an aspirant major power, I think we have to have a degree of scepticism in believing the idea that, this is a new axis. There certainly is heightened cooperation. Whether that translates into sustained cooperation is something we have to wait to see.
Philip Ruddock.
Could I ask you for a solution?
Well,
I was in discussions with Bond during the week for a parliamentary group, and we were focused very much upon the crisis in the Middle East, particularly in relation to the extraordinary number of refugees that we're having to accommodate. Mm. I mean, it's just impossible to see how that can be resolved without a solution. Yeah. Russia and China both have significant populations of Muslims. The Uyghur and the Chechens, I gather, have been involved in ISIS. I mean, isn't there a way that we can deal with Russia to get a solution and a peaceful outcome in Syria? And what's your solution?
I would like to say yes.
You've got 2 minutes.
I've got 2 minutes. Okay, I'd like to say yes. There would be quid pro quos with any solution. I don't think you're going to reach an agreement with Putin that doesn't include something such as Assad's days, or even more broader than that, we would like a sphere of influence, please, in our region. If you give us that, and in fact, the Russian National Security Statement says precisely this, that if NATO were to abandon encroachment into Russia's sphere of influence, then it would have very good relations with NATO. But that is just sheerly not going to happen. You're not going to have Poland, for instance, somehow abandon NATO. You're not going to have Ukraine not want to push for membership in the European Union. So the Kremlin, I think, does tend to link its participation in these types of conflicts to what it sees as more broader, intractable problems involving itself and the West. And its solution is always new institutions for new realities, or new architecture for new realities. That the end of the Cold War didn't produce anything new. It's all still NATO. So if you want to talk to us about Syria, then you know you need to start addressing these issues. You need to give Russia more of a say in minilateral negotiations. Is there a solution to Syria in the short term? I think no, and that's a horrible, nasty conclusion to reach. I don't think there is one. The best that can be done is to accommodate those waves and waves and waves of refugees as well as humanly possible, and various European governments have different takes on whether and how that should be done. Because the longer term issue will be, how do you resettle these people? How do you ensure that there's a stable Syrian state for these people to go back to? Or have you just emptied Syria of much of its population? I think that is going to be a medium to long term question, I'm afraid, and I hate to be pessimistic about it.
And at the moment, the Russians are just adding new waves of refugees. Kind of assault on Aleppo has just sent another 70,000 Syrians heading for the Turkish border. Yeah. Yes, here.
Tom Holcomb. In your report, you note that the Japanese and Russian relationship has soured over the past year due to actions by both countries. I was wondering if you think that the ship has sailed on a reset under Abe and Putin, and does Japan matter for a rebalance by Russia into the Asia Pacific?
Yes, Japan does matter. It matters partly because Abe was quite open to the idea of Russia tilting eastwards, even during the Ukraine crisis, the Crimea crisis. And it was that which forced him into a slightly different position. But he was open to new negotiations about, for instance, potential energy corridors, even some maritime cooperation. There is, of course, the symbolic issue of the Northern Territories and the Kuril Islands, which Boris Yeltsin was going to hand back in 1992. But he came down with a diplomatic cold, or at least he was grabbed by his Security Council and told, no, don't hand those back, please. So they will remain a sticking point, and actually signing a peace treaty ending World War II might be, or ending war between the two parties would probably be a good idea. Does it matter economically to Russia? It does, because Russia is looking for new clients. Does it matter for Japan? I think it does too, actually. I think it's very much in Japan's interest to have Russia in the region, but Russia in the region that plays by, that is a bit more predictable, if you like. The Japanese interest is not to have attention focused on Sino-Japanese rivalry, because attention will focus on that. If Russia is a constructive player, and I think there is a role for Russia to play, potentially, in Northeast Asia. As we talk about the Asia-Pacific as the big engine room of globalization, the Southeast Asians, we'll talk about Southeast Asian models for cooperation. Frankly, all the big dilemmas are in Northeast Asia. And the particular place I think Russia has a role to play is in relations with North Korea. In the past, it's been very much a bystander. On the six-party talks, it was prepared to turn up, didn't do very much at all, because it was mainly China's problem and China's solution. That if China turns off the aid tap to North Korea, then that's a real sign of, to come back into line. China did that, and the North Koreans said, well, so what? It may be that this thing will fare well. We know that this will fester on and on and on. So a more activist Russian role, I think, on that issue might be a good way, or one potential way, to help reset the Japan-Russia relationship.
Ladies and gentlemen, we always pride ourselves at the Institute at finishing on time. It's been a fascinating discussion today with you, Matthew. Thank you very much for joining us. And thank you all for coming again. I promise Russia is certainly back on our agenda, and we'll be doing a lot more on Russia this year. So this is just a little bit of a taster, both in our research and our events. But please join me in thanking Dr. Matthew Sussex. Thank you all for coming, and we'll see you next time.